Machiavelli simplifies. Don't sweat it. Move on. Both this saint and this sinner, then, see proportionality as a pathway. For Augustine, it shows rulers, however deeply into iniquity they may have descended, the way back from the city of man to the city of God. Machiavelli doesn't imagine communities that have never been seen or known to exist. But he does seek virtù, by which he means doing what's required when facing necessity, but not in all respects at its mercy. It's here that he's most original and most brave. As Machiavelli's finest translator has put it, justice is no more reasonable than what a person's prudence tells him he must acquire for himself or must submit to, because men cannot afford justice in any sense that transcends their own preservation. The cagey Florentine might have appreciated, for its literary qualities, Charles Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities. But he'd have thought it careless in the extreme for Sidney Carton, that novel's hero, to submit so gallantly at the end to the sound of knitting to his own disassembly. 10. States can't afford such irresponsibility, which is why they require strategies. These can't depend, Machiavelli insists, on discerning the will of God. It's presumptuous and foolhardy even to try. Man must manage on his own. But for that, he needs princes, and princes need advisors. The advisor can't tell the prince what to do, but he can suggest what the prince should know. For Machiavelli, this means seeking patterns across time, space, and status by shifting perspectives. Just as those who sketch landscapes place themselves down in the plain to consider the nature of mountains, and to consider the nature of low places, place themselves high atop mountains. Similarly, to know well the nature of peoples, one needs to be prince, and to know well the nature of princes, one needs to be of the people. Sketches, as Machiavelli sees them, convey complexity usably. They're not reality. They're not even finished representations of it. But they can transmit essential, if incomplete, information on short notice. They thus enhance, although they never replace, good judgment. Like Augustine's checklists, they show the directions in which a prince might lean, bend, or tilt while balancing opposites. They tether practices to principles in unknown futures by showing how these were tethered in known pasts. You can conquer a country, Machiavelli argues, by ruining its regime and by eliminating the ruling family's bloodline. You can move there and run it yourself, or you can let its people live by their laws, taking tribute from them and creating within them an oligarchical state which keeps them friendly to you. This makes the most sense, for a city used to living free may be held more easily by means of its own citizens than in any other mode, if one wants to preserve it. Machiavelli doesn't favor democracy in any modern sense, but he does incline away from brutality and toward consent. The great, he points out, he means the nobility, will always wish to oppress the people. The people will wish not to be oppressed. So where, within these polarities, should a prince be? Machiavelli's answer is simple, even quantifiable. A prince can never secure himself against a hostile people, as they are too many. Against the great, he can secure himself, as they are few. That doesn't mean courting popularity. It is, on the whole, much safer to be feared than loved. For love is held by a chain of obligation, which, because men are wicked, is broken at every opportunity. But fear is held by a dread of punishment that never forsakes you. Cruelties, however, should be swiftly administered, hence the logic of shock and awe, while benefits should be distributed slowly so that they may be tasted better. That's why a prince must learn when not to be good, Timing is everything. Machiavelli embraces, then, a utilitarian morality. You proportion your actions to your objective, not to progress from one nebulous city to another, but because some things have been shown to work and others haven't. Where Augustine is a closeted polytheist, uneasily juggling incompatibilities of God and reason, Machiavelli outs his own monotheism by seeking, above all, to minimize mess. If he praises duplicity, it's because it's efficient. How else, if you're not going to pray, can you reconcile within your own mind or policy contradictions? Machiavelli is always honest, if less often tactful. He is, one of his biographers has written, the least Machiavellian of men. 11. What, though, is the objective? I think it's Augustine's vision of justice, which order must precede. Only a state can provide stability, but Augustine's reports only to his God. Machiavelli is no atheist, but his God doesn't run states. That the Roman Catholic Church still has one, if much diminished from that of the Christian Roman emperors, interests, exasperates, and sometimes amuses Machiavelli. But it's not the future. Indeed, he blames the Church for keeping Italy divided when states elsewhere are organizing, not by cities or regions, but rather cultures, languages, and emergent civilizations. Who, then, will oversee them? They'll do it themselves, Machiavelli replies, by balancing power. First, there'll be a balance among states, unlike older Roman and Catholic traditions of universality. Machiavelli anticipates the statecraft of Richelieu, Metternich, Bismarck, the second Kennan, and Henry Kissinger. Enshrined formally in the 1648 Treaty of Westphalia, it saw little significance in the internal configuration of states. What mattered was their external behavior. But Machiavelli understands balancing in a second and subtler sense, conveying more explicitly in the discourses than in the prince. It is only in republics that the common good is looked to properly and that all that promotes it is carried out. And, however much this or that private person may be the loser on this account, there are so many who benefit thereby that the common good can be realized in spite of those few who suffer in consequence. This idea of an internal equilibrium within which competition strengthens community wouldn't appear again until Adam Smith unveiled an invisible hand in The Wealth of Nations, 1776, until the American founding fathers drafted and in the Federalist justified constitutional checks and balances, 1787-88, and until Immanuel Kant linked republics, however distantly, with perpetual peace, 1795. From all of this would emerge the 20th century idea of an international system consistent with order and justice, although Augustine had foreseen it long before. This is not to claim that Augustine influenced Machiavelli, who influenced Westphalia, which influenced Woodrow Wilson. History doesn't require direct inheritances. But this 1600-year search for justice, an aspiration, by way of order, a capability, suggests a persisting pattern. Thucydides might have regarded it as one of his recurring resemblances, human nature being what it is. It followed, then, that distillations of these, if sharply focused and succinctly presented, could prepare states for the future. Machiavelli most closely met this standard. The Prince, to paraphrase Pangloss, is the best of all policy briefs. All the more so for its authors having never, ever confused power with PowerPoint. 12. The first Kennan Siberians, the saintly Augustine, and the sinful Machiavelli, devised strategies for salvation, the Siberians from blizzards, earthquakes, diseases, famines, and shimmering lights in the night sky, the saint from disorder on earth and fires in hell, the sinner from incompetent rulers and the failed states they ran. The Siberians sacrificed animals to satisfy gods. The saint sought reason in a single god. The sinner did without gods and God altogether. Siberians had unwritten rituals of propitiation. Augustine mapped imaginary cities in a big book. Machiavelli prepared a brief for a prince whose attention span in no way matched that of its subsequent readers. All prescribed procedures. Do this, now do that. All related the past to the future. This worked before, it's worth trying again. All employed checklists. Before you do anything, be sure of what you're trying to do and make sure you have what you'll need. You can't and shouldn't do everything, though, so you'll also select, here's what we can afford, or here's what's right. You proportion aspirations to capabilities. These are opposites, the first being free from limits and the second bound by them, but they must connect. That happens only when you hold both in mind simultaneously. It's not easy. Augustine failed to show how God's omnipotence could coexist with man's freedom. Machiavelli solved that problem. God didn't want to do everything, but created another by leaving God with little to do. These loose ends remained, uncomfortably, until 1953, when Isaiah Berlin gave a lecture. He called it The Originality of Machiavelli, but the essay it became rebuilt Augustine's cities, without ever mentioning them. Why, Berlin asked, had Machiavelli upset so many people over so many years? The Elizabethans alone condemned him in print some 400 times. My sleepless students follow a long tradition. Machiavelli indeed lacked tact, but he'd trigger-warned in the Prince that he wouldn't ornament his prose. He had few illusions. It was Hobbes, however, who called life solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Nor did Machiavelli disguise unpleasant realities. It was Augustine, though, who said of babies that they did no harm only through lack of strength. Machiavelli's great transgression, Berlin concluded, was to confirm what everyone knows, but no one will admit, that ideals cannot be attained. Statecraft, therefore, can never balance realism against idealism. There are only competing realisms. There is no contest in governing between politics and morality. There is only politics. And no state respects Christian teaching on saving souls. The incompatibilities are irreconcilable. To deny this is, in Berlin's words, but in Machiavelli's mind, to vacillate, fall between two stools, and end in weakness and failure. What, then, to do? It helped that Machiavelli and Berlin had lightness of being, for their answer is the same. Don't sweat it. Learn to live with the contradictions. Machiavelli shows no trace of agony, Berlin points out, and he doesn't either. Anchorites can always practice their virtues in the desert, while martyrs will obtain their reward hereafter. Machiavelli is interested in public affairs, in security, independence, success, glory, strength, vigor, felicity on earth, not in heaven. In the present and future, as well as the past. In the real world, not an imaginary one. And so, except for monks on parched poles, Augustine's city of God no longer exists on earth. The city of man, which survives, has no single path to salvation. The belief that the correct, objectively valid solution to the question of how men should live can in principle be discovered, Berlin finds, is itself in principle not true. Machiavelli thus split open the rock upon which Western beliefs and lives had been founded. It was he who lit the fatal fuse. 13. But fatal to what? Faith in single solutions, Berlin shows, has led both Catholics and Protestants, both conservatives and communists, to defend enormities which freeze the blood of ordinary men. Machiavelli's blood ran colder than was ordinary. He praised Cesare Borgia, for example, and he refused to condemn torture despite having suffered it. Augustine, never tortured, took a similar position. Machiavelli was careful, however, to apportion enormities. They should only forestall greater horrors. Violent revolution, defeat in war, descent into anarchy, mass killing, or what we today would call genocide. Berlin sees in this an economy of violence, by which he means holding a reserve of force always in the background to keep things going in such a way that the virtues admired by Machiavelli and by the classical thinkers to whom he appeals can be protected and allowed to flower. It's no accident that Berlin uses the plural, for it comes closer than the singular in English to Machiavelli's virtu, implying no single standard by which men must live. There are many different ends that men may seek and still be fully rational, Berlin insists, capable of understanding and deriving light from each other. Otherwise, civilizations would exist in impenetrable bubbles, incomprehensible to anyone on the outside. Intercommunication between cultures in time and space is possible only because what makes men human is common to them and acts as a bridge between them. But our values are ours, and theirs are theirs. Herein lie, then, the roots of toleration, historically the product of the realization of the irreconcilability of equally dogmatic faiths and the practical improbability of complete victory of one over the other. These extend to the painful stretch, as if on a rack, between what public life demands and what private life allows. Only anchorites, on their poles, are above politics. Perhaps there are other worlds in which all principles are harmonized, but it is on earth that we live, and it is here that we must believe and act. By shattering certainty, Machiavelli showed how. The dilemma has never given men peace since it came to light, Berlin lightly concludes, but we have learnt to live with it. Chapter 5. Princes as Pivots. My dictionary defines a pivot as a pin, point, or short shaft on the end of which something rests and turns, or upon and about which something rotates or oscillates. Posterity has long regarded Augustine and Machiavelli as pivots in the history of Western thought, because each, with enduring effects, shifted long-standing relationships between souls and states. Neither, however, could have known that this would happen. They'd have found it surprising to have eclipsed, in posthumous prominence, the princes they served, for whom obscurity, during their lifetimes, was impossible. Their lowliest subjects would have heard of them. The loftiest lords quailed before them. The health, mental stability, and reproductive prowess of princes could cause faiths to rise and nations to fall. They were the international celebrities of their time. Societies for centuries pivoted on them, but not in just the same way. Somewhere in England, sometime in the late 16th century, a young nobleman arrives late for a banquet. Still panting from having run, he kneels before the guest of honor, bows his head in embarrassment, and offers a bowl of rose water. Such was his shyness that he saw no more of her than her ringed hand, but it was enough. It was a memorable hand, A thin hand with long fingers always curling as if round orb or scepter. A nervous, crabbed, sickly hand. A commanding hand. A hand that had only to raise itself for a head to fall. A hand, he guessed, attached to an old body that smelt like a cupboard in which furs are kept in camphor. Which body was yet caparisoned in all sorts of brocades and gems, and held itself very upright, though perhaps in pain from sciatica, and never flinched, though strung together by a thousand fears. And the queen's eyes were light yellow. For it is she, Elizabeth R., as she styles herself, and even though the occasion is imagined, the youth will remain youthful, owing possibly to an unexpected gender transformation well into the 20th century, this passage from Virginia Woolf's biography novel, Orlando, brings us as close to the great aging queen as we, from this distance, are likely to get. Meanwhile, in Spain, a dead king is being remembered, at his funeral, as a hand loom weaver. That profession might seem easy, the eulogist insists, but in reality it is very hard. Extremities must coordinate while eyes remain focused and the brain keeps track, for any of innumerable threads may at any moment unravel, tangle, or break. Such is the life of a king, writing with his hands, traveling with his feet, his heart attached to threads, one to Flanders, another to Italy, another to Africa, another to Peru, another to Mexico, another to the English Catholics, another to preserving peace among Christian princes, another to the problems of the Holy Roman Empire. Is the thread to the Indies broken? Hurry up and tie it. Is the thread to Flanders broken? Run and fix it. Such a busy life, divided among so many threads. Oh, what excellent regal qualities found in no one else. The king was Philip II. The date is 1598, and Dr. Aguilar de Terrones' sermon, unlike Orlando's obeisance, is real. His metaphor matches Wolfe's, however, in its evocation of character, and, by implication, of divergent pivoting in princely rule. Philip rushes from crisis to crisis, rarely resting, never fully in control. He's whacking moles, and they pop up everywhere. Elizabeth, in contrast, refuses to hurry. She'll whack when she has to, the raised hand can indeed remove a head, but she sets times and places. She resists unnecessary expenditures of resources, energy, reputation, and, unusually in a monarch, virginity. For like Penelope in the Odyssey, she's beset by suitors. Unlike Penelope, however, Elizabeth weaves strategies, not shrouds. The king, an Augustinian, sees his empire as a shroud connecting the city of man to the city of God, no part of which is dispensable. Rather than prejudice the faith or God's service in the slightest way, he pledges at one point, I will lose all my dominions and 100 lives if I had them. The queen, more Machiavellian, regards her state, not yet an empire, as a stage for performance, rather than as a holy relic. Be ye insured, she tells Londoners at her coronation, that I will be as good unto you as ever queen was, and that for the safety and quietness of you all, I will not spare, if need be, to spend my blood. Philip promises obedience to God, not his subjects. Elizabeth serves her subjects, fitting God to their interests. The king, looking to heaven, venerates. The queen, feet on earth, calculates. The differences test the ideas of Augustine and Machiavelli against the demands of statecraft at the dawn of the modern age. 1. Both monarchs would have absorbed Augustine from Catholic doctrine, Philip avidly, Elizabeth grudgingly. She was, unmistakably, Henry VIII's daughter, and both may have read Machiavelli. Philip's father, the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, carefully studied the prince, and the Florentine's works were in Philip's library, even though marked as on the Pope's list of prohibited books. Translations made Machiavelli infamous in England as Elizabeth was growing up, but she, skilled at languages, could have read him in the original Italian. Neither she nor Philip left commentaries. Where they placed themselves within the two traditions, though, is clear enough. Princess Elizabeth, not yet 20, grumbled openly when forced to attend Mass following the accession to the throne of her Catholic half-sister Mary in 1553. After becoming queen 5 years later, Elizabeth stalked out of services she disliked and loudly corrected sermons she'd stayed to hear. She reinstated, as one of her first acts, her godfather Thomas Cranmer's Book of Common Prayer, for which Mary had burned him at the stake. Like her real father, Elizabeth sought not to abolish English Catholicism, but to nationalize it by denying papal authority over the state she ruled. It was, after all, apart from an already fractious Irish colony, the only one she had. When Charles V abdicated in 1555 to 56, he ruled more states than he could easily remember. Spain and its New World territories of Mexico and Peru, the Netherlands, Burgundy, large portions of Italy, Austria, Hungary, and Bohemia, as well as scattered outposts along the North African coast and in what would become the Philippines. King Philip II inherited most of this, along with an apology from his father for the extreme gap he'd left between revenues and expenses. The new monarch must give up nothing, though, for honor and reputation were everything. In squaring this circle, Philip should place his faith in what is most certain, which is God, to whom it would fall to find a way. Non sufficit orbis, a medal struck for Philip proclaimed in 1583, after he'd taken over Portugal and its overseas colonies. The world is not enough. The phrase dates from Alexander the Great, but it couldn't have been said of his empire, as it was now of Spain's, that the sun never set on it. How, though, could one king rule it? With Philip's lands that much more extensive than Elizabeth's, he should have found delegation easier than she. Their practice, however, was just the opposite. Elizabeth readily yielded authority, whether to court favorites, complacent clerics, wealthy nobles, enterprising sea captains, or to all of her subjects over the inner makeup, on matters of faith, of their own minds. She didn't even design her own palace. She simply took over or borrowed the ones she fancied. In this, she followed Machiavelli. For if God didn't want to do everything, why should she? It was enough to awe, to set limits, and, like Augustus, to let things grow, while retaining, deftly if possible, fiercely if necessary, her own autonomy. Philip, like Augustine, saw God's hand in all that happened. That made God's interests and those of the king, his agent, inseparable. Authority, hence, could hardly be shared, despite the months required for orders in a global empire to produce actions. And palaces? Philip personally designed the Escorial, the grandest monastery any monarch would ever inhabit. He then filled it with relics and sequestered himself among them, unable to see beyond the responsibilities that engulfed him and, as a consequence, the paperwork that swamped him. The ruler of a microstate who macromanaged, therefore, coexisted in time with the ruler of a macrostate who micromanaged. This made no sense in terms of geography, logistics, or communications. But as a reflection of royal minds, and through them, of contrasting philosophies on the alignment of souls with states, it made perfect sense, so much so that the future of the world Europe would soon rule, pivoted on the distinction. 2. Philip was once, and wanted again to be, England's king. Queen Mary had married him in 1554, hoping for an heir while linking her states with the Catholic great powers of Europe. Charles V, still Holy Roman Emperor, favored the union, and Philip, not yet King of Spain, dutifully agreed. But Mary's only pregnancy turned out to be false, and Philip, whose authority in England was only matrimonial, spent little time there. Marriage to a foreign prince made Mary unpopular. She became more so by sending hundreds of other heretics into the flames that consumed Cranmer, and by losing Calais, England's last continental outpost, to the French in 1558. Mary died, little mourned, later that year. With her death, Philip, now the fully empowered ruler of an earth-circling empire, lost his nominal power in a small, sun-deprived island. Elizabeth's position, while Mary ruled, had been precarious. As the daughter of Anne Boleyn, whom Henry VIII had married, disavowed, and beheaded, she had no clear claim to the throne. She showed little respect for the Roman Catholicism Mary was reimposing. She knew of, even if she didn't participate in, plots to overthrow the queen. The principal danger Elizabeth posed, though, was popularity. Ever the performer, the princess played the contrast for all it was worth. Mary kept her in limbo, at times receiving her warmly, at others holding her at a distance under house, actually castle, arrest, and at one point imprisoning her in the Tower of London, causing Elizabeth to fear her mother's fate. Her most influential protector was Philip. If Mary were to die without issue, or if childbirth were to kill her, as it did so many women in her time, he preferred having Elizabeth as queen instead of her cousin Mary Stuart, presumptive heir to the throne of Scotland. This Mary had grown up in France, Spain's greatest rival, and had long been betrothed to Francis, the son of King Henry II. There was also the possibility, if Elizabeth did rule, that the widowed Philip could marry her. As Queen Mary's health worsened, England teetered between French and Spanish spheres of influence. Philip knew which way he wanted it to go. And what of Elizabeth? She professed satisfaction, as princess, with her single state. But after becoming queen in November 1558, she was widely expected to follow Mary's example, take a husband, and if more fortunate, give birth to an heir. Their father, after all, had made succession by bloodline his central, if brutal, priority. The Roman alternative of adoption, which might have saved him a lot of trouble, had long since fallen into disuse. With few exceptions, legitimacy now required royal births. Rarely, as yet, though, of ruling queens. Marriages, however risky for Henry's consorts, had never put his life in danger, but Elizabeth's, with each pregnancy, would be. Even if these went well, independence, which she valued no less than her father, would collide with the near-universal presumption that wives should defer to husbands. Mary, with the sole right to rule, had nonetheless allowed Philip to drag her into the war with France that lost Calais. Looks, too, could be a problem. Elizabeth preferred eye-pleasing men, but couldn't marry an English favorite without enraging others. A foreign marriage would avoid that. Distance made it difficult, however, for royal couples to see each other before deals were done, and pre-photographic images could mislead disastrously. Recalling Henry VIII's revulsion on meeting his fourth wife, Anne of Cleves, only days before their wedding, Elizabeth wisely insisted that she wouldn't trust portrait painters. She'd seen Philip when he was in England, though, and she knew, even if she didn't like to acknowledge, that he'd tried to keep her safe. Philip wasted no time after Mary's death in proposing to Elizabeth, but the new queen turned him down, noting politely that their realms could have the amicable relations he said he wanted without a wedding. The king's real purpose, he revealed privately, had been to prevent that lady from making the changes in religion that she has in mind, and so to serve God. Hers was to modify religion in order to reclaim independence from Rome. The disparity became clear within months of Elizabeth's accession, at which point Philip proposed to Isabel of France, the daughter of Henry II, who became his new wife. Elizabeth would entertain, over the next quarter century, well over a dozen suitors, each of whom, after varying degrees of dalliance, she spurned. Her motives remain unclear. Perhaps she feared sex or childbirth. Perhaps her father's marriages haunted her. Perhaps she wished to share her throne with no rival, however titular. Perhaps she put off a decision until it was too late. She was juggling proposals well into her 40s. But the most likely explanation is that Elizabeth prized pivoting. Her strategy, the historian Garrett Mattingly has explained, was to arrange the courtiers and counselors around her, the diplomats and envoys, the kings and powers of the continent, in an elaborate interlocked design so cunningly and delicately balanced that each part should counteract another, and she herself should always be free. The price, to be sure, was loneliness. Wolf's uprightness strung together by a thousand fears. But as Philip's interests corresponded, in his mind, with those of God, so Elizabeth's paralleled those of her modest but potentially pivotal island state. 3. Philip found himself more often a pincushion than a pivot, stuck on multiple points at once. He was repelling a French attack on the Netherlands when he learned of Mary's death, as well as that of his father, the recently abdicated Charles V, in Spain. What happened in England would determine Catholicism's future there, but Philip had for too long neglected his Spanish homeland. It would dishearten the Dutch, however, to leave without making peace. Although my presence here does nothing to win them over, I think they would be happy with any sovereign except me. They'd confirm this by reducing his income, while his sister, Juana, serving as regent in Spain, so flatly rejected his request to her for additional funds that Philip feared he was being laughed at. And yet, the king insisted, as an absolute monarch, he need not acknowledge any temporal superior on this earth. How could Philip have no superior, but be paralyzed by constraints? One reason is that his family, the ubiquitous Habsburgs, had long privileged dynastic ties over geographic, economic, or cultural affinities. They conquered, it was said, by marrying. As a result, Philip ruled, and depended on revenues from, a patchwork of peoples owing him little loyalty. Non-contiguous boundaries compounded the problem, as did the king's dislike of delegating authority. His mind could be in multiple places at once, hence his multiple dilemmas. Placing Philip's body in that position, however, was beyond even God's capabilities. The Romans managed more of Europe than Philip, and populations at least as diverse, arguably with greater efficiency. But their lands adjoined one another, their administrators didn't see delegation as religious dereliction, and their only competitors were barbarians who took centuries to wear their victims down. Philip had to contend with the French, the English, the Dutch, the Portuguese, the Holy Roman Empire, the Ottomans, the papacy, and, most unnervingly, the Protestant Reformation, which was spreading its heresies throughout much of the continent. With this many moles to whack, it's hardly surprising that the king was at war somewhere for all but 6 months of his 43 years on the throne. From a secular standpoint, he didn't do badly. Philip lost none of the territories Charles V left him. Spain wouldn't give up the Netherlands until half a century after Philip's death, and Portugal, with its overseas possessions, would remain Spanish for 6 decades. Spain's own New World dominions, extending eventually from mid-North America to Tierra del Fuego, survived into the early 19th century and in fragments until 1898, a longevity rivaling that of the British Empire. Even Philip's debts, about which he complained constantly and on which he defaulted repeatedly, may have been, by modern standards, sustainable. Philip judged himself, though, on a loftier scale. He sought to serve God and the empire only to the extent that it advanced God's interests. All other goals required shutting your ears and even your eyes, for they were, by definition, unworthy. Believe me, this is the simplest, least stressful, and most sure path for everything. No doubt it was as long as God provided the means to achieve his ends. To Philip's bewilderment, however, God could be as parsimonious as the difficult Dutch. Since all depended on his will, Philip wrote in 1559, "I can only wait for whatever he is pleased to grant. I hope that he will provide me with the means to hold on to my dominions and not let them be lost because I lack the means to hold on to them, which would be the saddest thing for me and something I would regret more than anything else one can think of, and much more than if I lost them in battle. My only aim is to get it right," the king lamented, "but I am so unlucky that when I want something, it often turns out badly. This is how the world works." What Philip wanted was loyalty from his subjects, prosperity within his provinces, credibility among his competitors, a return to orthodoxy where it had been endangered, and, more vaguely, a world that was not enough. He failed to see incompatibles, and hence the need to pursue certain objectives at the expense of others. The king resisted prioritizing ends, even though God himself had chosen selectively to provide means. Instead, Philip lashed himself with Augustinian anxieties. How could a world working against God's agent, which Philip believed he was, reflect God's intentions, which Philip believed it must? God couldn't be inconsistent like Jupiter, or evil like Satan. But he could, Augustine had suggested, be instructional. God could make men fail in order to better themselves, whether in this world or the next. That became the basis for Philip's grand strategy, not to plan with a view to pivoting, but, in the manner of saintly pin-cushioned martyrs, to suffer. "Pray God that in heaven," he wrote lugubriously in 1569, "we shall be treated better." 4. Elizabeth, like Machiavelli, neither expected nor needed reassurance. She thanked God, not Philip, for her survival as princess, but as queen, rarely sought instruction from anyone, terrestrial or divine. "She is a very strange sort of woman," Count de Feria, Spain's ambassador, reported after finding the new monarch relaxed, even laughing, as if she were reading his mind. "She must have been thoroughly schooled in the manner in which her father conducted his affairs. She is determined to be governed by no one." Feria was among the first, but by no means the last, of Elizabeth's perplexed interlocutors. She could be childlike or canny, forthright or devious, brave or risk-averse, forgiving or vindictive, serene or volcanic, even feminine or masculine. "I have the body but of a weak, feeble woman," she told her troops as the Spanish Armada sailed for home in 1588. "But I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England, too." Relishing opposites, the queen was constant only in her patriotism, her insistence on keeping ends within means, and her determination, a requirement for pivoting, never to be pinned down. Her hopes for religion reflected this. Knowing the upheavals her country had undergone, Henry VIII's expulsion of the Pope from English Catholicism, the shift to strict Protestantism in Edward VI's brief reign, the harsh reversion to Rome under Mary, Elizabeth wanted a single church with multiple ways of worship. There was, she pointed out, only one Jesus Christ. Why couldn't there be different paths to him? Theological quarrels were trifles, or more tartly, ropes of sand or sea slime leading to the moon. Until they affected national sovereignty. God's church, under Elizabeth, would be staunchly English. Whether Catholic or Protestant mattered less than loyalty. This was, in one sense, toleration, for the new queen cared little what her subjects believed. She would watch like a hawk, though, what they did. Her Majesty seems to me incomparably more feared than her sister, Fetia warned Philip, which was saying something, since that lady had been Bloody Mary. We have lost a kingdom, body and soul. Diplomacy and defense, too, would be self-reliant. Blessed with an island, not Philip's scattered provinces, Elizabeth could avoid the costs of a standing army, adapt her navy for protection or provocation, and align her state as necessary, never permanently, with the continental enemies of her enemies. God's gift to England was geography, which piety wouldn't augment or its absence diminish. Ireland and Scotland, the latter still an independent country, remained running sores. The French and Spanish attempted to exploit unrest in both territories. But Elizabeth's rebels never caused her the trouble Philip had in trying to suppress the Dutch, who from 1572 were in revolt, with England's help when the Queen chose to give it. By resisting military commitments while enforcing domestic economies, Elizabeth balanced revenues and expenses during most of her reign, even running a surplus in its second and third decades. In contrast to Philip, she never declared bankruptcy. We don't usually connect fiscal responsibility with lightness of being, but in Elizabeth, they aligned. Lightness allowed flirtation, which cost less than obligation, whether to suitors or to their realms. It eased delegation. The Queen loved performing, but also others' performances. It facilitated strategic mischief. When short of funds, Elizabeth allowed her navy to raid Philip's treasure ships returning from America. Perhaps, she suggested in response to his protests, they'd been the victims of pirates? The Queen's lightness also upended courtiers, leaving her in control. A memorable victim was the Earl of Oxford, who, one day while bowing respectfully, farted loudly. Elizabeth said nothing and seemed not to notice, but Oxford, humiliated, went into exile for 7 years. At last he reappeared, bowed again, this time silently, and waited anxiously. "My lord," the queen responded, I like to think after a slight pause, "I had forgot the fart." Pivoting requires gyroscopes, and Elizabeth's were the best of her era. She balanced purposefulness with imagination, guile, humor, timing, and an economy in movement that, however extravagant her display, kept her steady on the tightrope she walked. Philip's gyroscopes, if he had any, malfunctioned constantly. She, without visible effort, retained the initiative in all she did. He exhausted himself regaining it in one place while losing it somewhere else. She deftly turned adversaries against each other. He ponderously united them against himself. She, running a poor state, kept it solvent. He, running a rich one, begged and borrowed. She never felt not up to her role. He worried repeatedly that he was not up to his. Machiavelli, thinking gyroscopically, advised his prince to be a lion and a fox, the former to frighten wolves, the latter to detect snares. Elizabeth went him one better by being lion, fox, and female, a combination the crafty Italian might have learned to appreciate. Philip was a grand lion, but he was only a lion. Such princes can, through conscientiousness, Machiavelli warned, become trapped. For a wise ruler cannot observe faith, nor should he, when such observance turns against him, and the causes that made him promise have been eliminated. Nor does a prince ever lack legitimate causes to color his failure to observe faith. Philip, reporting to an all-seeing God, found coloring beyond his capabilities. Maybe that's why he always wore black. Elizabeth, reporting only to herself, dazzled. Age could not wither her, nor custom stale, her infinite variety. 5. When Machiavelli wrote of faith in this context, he didn't necessarily mean religious conviction. His point was simply that circumstances change, and that princes shouldn't impose old promises on new situations. He wasn't anticipating the Protestant Reformation. He'd hardly had time, before dying in 1527, to become aware of Martin Luther. Half a century later, though, the conduct of statecraft couldn't so easily dismiss religious differences. Elizabeth and Philip had to decide where the observance of faith coincided, and didn't, with the obligations of princely rule. They managed a wary demarcation through most of the 1560s. Philip was consolidating his position in Spain and securing the Mediterranean from the Ottoman Turks. Elizabeth was expanding England's influence in Scotland, where a French civil war had deprived Mary Stuart, now Queen of Scots, of external support. But an Anglo-Spanish détente would require insulation from religion, and growing Protestant unrest in the Netherlands, a strategic sensitivity for both monarchs, was making that increasingly unlikely. It forced Philip into costly military campaigns that threatened but also tempted Elizabeth. Spain's success would entrench a Catholic superpower dangerously close on the English Channel. Not, however, without vast costs, which only American gold and silver could cover. Elizabeth's navy could intercept Spanish ships anywhere along their long route, leaving her free, because distance delayed communications, to avow or disavow its actions. Closer to home, but with similar slipperiness, she could hide Dutch pirates in English ports. She thus had a chokehold, annoying, if not lethal, on Philip's northern European foothold. Religion was also undermining diplomacy. Elizabeth's ambassador got himself banned from the Spanish court for mocking the Pope and conducting Protestant services. Citing diplomatic immunity, she refused to replace him. Meanwhile, Philip's emissary in London was secretly communicating with Mary Stuart, now deposed as Scotland's queen, who'd fled to England and sought Elizabeth's protection. Philip himself, in 1569, assured Mary of his sympathy and support as long as she remained, she'd been known to waver, a resolute Catholic. With the French having abandoned Mary, Philip no longer feared her alignment with them. And so he returns to the project he'd suspended a decade earlier, reviving Roman Catholicism in England. Then he'd hoped for Elizabeth's help, perhaps even through marriage. Now he'd written her off. God must be allowing her sins and unfaithfulness so that she will be lost. It was clear, therefore, that after my special obligation to maintain my own states in our holy faith, I am bound to make every effort in order to restore and preserve it in England, as in former times. Philip placed his plan within a larger revival of Catholic crusading, aimed this time at liberating Canterbury, not Jerusalem. The Augustinian obligation to serve the state had evolved into a papal obligation to serve the church, no longer by ridding the Holy Land of infidels, that was a lost cause, but by killing European Christians who'd rejected Rome's authority. Henry VIII had made England a prime target, and in 1570, Pope Pius V did his part by excommunicating Elizabeth, in effect licensing the faithful not only to overthrow, but to assassinate her. The Duke of Alba, commander of Philip's armies in the Netherlands, found all of these ideas impractical. Even though the principal means must come from God, as Your Majesty very virtuously and piously suggests, it seems necessary to examine what human resources would be needed to carry out your wishes. He had no confidence that he could launch a cross-channel attack, or if he did, that it would succeed, or if it did, that Elizabeth's Catholics would betray her, or if they did, that the English, whatever their faith, would accept Mary as their new queen. The piled-up contingencies alarmed Alba, for whom pacifying the Dutch in a much smaller country had proven difficult enough. Philip ordered him, nonetheless, to proceed. "I am so attached to the invasion in my heart, and I am so convinced that God, our Savior, must embrace it as his own cause, that I cannot be dissuaded, nor can I accept or believe the contrary." Having told God what to do, however, Philip lost track of what he had to do. Micromanaging an empire on which the sun never set tended to blur his vision. To Alba's relief, but to the exasperation of Pius V, and even more to that of his successor, Gregory XIII, the king allowed his great scheme to drift. All that Philip accomplished in the end was to alert Elizabeth, who saw that she could no longer afford toleration. She may not have been, when she became queen, as feared as Bloody Mary, but she now knew that she had to be. 6. The Pope's edicts made it impossible, Elizabeth's biographer Anne Somerset has written, to be both a good Catholic and a good Englishman. For with Philip to the south, conspiring with Mary Stuart in the north, England was theologically, if not yet militarily, under siege. Hawk-like vigilance, even vengeance, was necessary. Elizabeth had already unleashed the latter in 1569, in the aftermath of an anti-Protestant rebellion, badly run and quickly suppressed, in northern England. Worried that its leaders might free the former Queen of Scots, under castle arrest nearby, Elizabeth turned viciously on their followers, ordering more executions for a single uprising than Henry VIII or Mary Tudor had ever done. She insisted on killing the meaner sort of rebels for the terror of others, presumably their betters. The poor, the queen explained, must worthily suffer death. Vigilance paid off with the discovery, in 1571, of the most elaborate plot yet to invade England, depose Elizabeth, and put Mary Stuart on the throne. A Florentine banker, Roberto Ridolfi, had made himself the link connecting Pius V, Mary, Philip, and the Duke of Alba, the only conspirator who questioned the feasibility of what he proposed. Ridolfi proved him right by talking too much, allowing Elizabeth's spy masters to track what was happening and, at the right moment, expose it. Mary was lucky, after this, to retain her head, but it was, henceforth, precariously positioned. Like many leaders who like to think they're loved, Elizabeth professed indifference to her own security. This worried her counselors, keenly aware that she hadn't produced or designated an heir. But here, delegation paid off. In 1573, she made Sir Francis Walsingham, her Secretary of State, with orders to do whatever was necessary, she needn't know what, to guard queen and country. This Elizabeth could accept, for she'd made the two the same. Convinced that there was less danger in fearing too much than too little, Walsingham took counter-espionage, or spyery, as it was then known, to unprecedented extremes. Using bribery, theft, entrapment, blackmail, and torture, he built a network of informants stretching across Europe. It's hard to say that it wasn't needed. The Pope was routinely encouraging assassination now, and Philip himself had approved Elizabeth's murder if it would make Mary Stuart queen. What we like to recall as the Elizabethan Golden Age survived only through surveillance and terror. That was another of its contradictions.